Hey, everybody, it's Sunny. I just wanted to let you know that you should be listening at the Patreon. Go to subbeacon.com. You'll easily find it. You would have gotten this episode last month when Ferrari was still in theaters, but this episode is about Ferrari, which is, I think, on VOD now. You can watch it at home. Check it out. Listen. Go sign up at the Patreon, and we'll see you over there, where we have new episodes every Monday now, also on the new season of Reacher. Reacher, big hit, huge hit. Everybody's watching Reacher. It's not really very good, but we enjoy talking about it. So go sign up, and we'll have more content for you every week. You'll never get those episodes here on this feed if you want to have Reacher talk. Get some rounds of Reacher rounds, if you will.
Two objects cannot occupy the same point in space, the same moment in time. The corner races at you. You have perhaps a crisis of identity. Am I a sportsman? Or a competitor?
If you get into one of my cars, you get in the wind.
Welcome back to another episode of the Subbeacon Podcast. I am your co-host, Mike Warren. I am joined, as always, by my two co-hosts, who are two objects who cannot be in the same place at the same time, Jonathan V. Last and Sunny Bunch. Join us over at subbeacon.com. I usually say here you get episodes every Friday. Of course, we're releasing this on Saturday. It's a little Saturday special for all of you. Normally on Friday mornings, get those bonus episodes on Monday mornings only at subbeacon.com. Join us there. You can comment. Everybody has a grand old time in the comments over at subbeacon.com. Become a patron, and we'll see you over there. Later in this show, we'll be talking about Ferrari. But first, how's everyone doing? JVL, you got some denim talk for us?
Got some denim updates.
Oh,
really good. And I owe you guys, the people, because one of you texted... People. One of you listeners texted either Sonny or Mike and said, actually,
it was Amazon, a comment.
It was a comment at subbeacon.com. Well,
yeah. Thank you, guys. I don't read the comments anymore because people are always mean to me, but I appreciate you, who was nice to me, and said that the Amazon was still holding stock of Prana Axioms. And so I went, and I currently am the owner of 12 pairs of Prana Axioms. Oh, it's so great to know. Comfort and the sense of serenity that comes from knowing that you have a dozen pairs of these jeans now just sitting there waiting for me whenever I need them. It feels like freedom.
You bought a dozen pairs of these instead of three pairs of Japanese selvedge denim.
Yes.
Is my understanding. That feels like a mistake. I feel and like you got to go.
Because these were closeouts. Because these were closeouts, I was buying them at like 70% off of the sticker price. So it just a great deal all around. Of course, I'm still working on the used pairs of jeans. I'm still trying to bend that denim to my will.
Bend them to your will, yeah.
I do have a question about the Japanese denim, because that is a whole thing as well. And if you want Japanese denim, you're going to pay extra for that. Because evidently the Japanese do denim slightly differently and better than everyone else. Part of me is curious, Yellow, that I would like to just experiment once.
No. It's I am curious blue.
Oh, I am curious blue. I would like to try just one pair of Japanese denim just to see what it's all about.
That's your bucket list, Gene.
Slip into some Japanese denim.
I think it is. I just just like to sample it. Anyway, it's all good. How are you boys? What's going on?
Sunny, what's up?
Not a whole lot. Are you guys familiar with what is happening in the world of ladies' water cups? The Stanley.
You're talking about this and not the pop-up weddings? Because I really want to do both. Can we do both? We got time.
Okay.
We got plenty of time here. I mean, I don't have a lot to say here, but it is, so there's this bizarre trend of upper middle class women going out and buying these thermoses, these Stanley, like 40 ounce thermos water with a straw and everything. And there's madness. People are lining up at Target to get the limited new Beanie Babies. It's kind of like Beanie Babies. They're slightly more useful than Beanie Babies, I guess.
It's a little more of a status symbol too than Beanie Babies was like collectible.
Yeah, and this is gotten to the point now where like my daughter wanted one for Christmas, right? Like we got her one, but we got her the wrong kind of Stanley.
Did you get, like, the knockoff?
It's a Stanley, but it's like a smaller size. We got it so it would fit in her backpack. Yeah,
you didn't get her, which I've seen this online, because before Stanley made these trendy cups, like they also made like legit thermoses.
That's what they were known as. That's what I knew them as.
Exactly.
I know what Stanleys are. They're like camping.
I've seen the video of the woman whose husband got her a Stanley cup, and it's one of those, like, it looks like you're taking it to the coal mine, and it's got your tomato soup in there for lunch. And she's like outraged. She's like, this is not what, but that's a Stanley, or it was a Stanley.
Right. So the only thing worse than not having a thing, as we all know, is having the wrong version of this thing.
That's death.
Because like, it's one thing if you don't have the thing and like, you don't have it. It's one thing. But then if you have the wrong version of the thing, it looks like you're trying to have the thing, mm-hmm. but you get, obviously we got her the right one. And it's like,
question.
Yeah.
Did she open the package on the right one?
Oh yeah.
Oh, she didn't keep it in the pristine packaging. Did she use it, or did she send it off to have it graded? Because I assume that what you would want to do is get a PSA graded. So you just keep your Stanley water cup in its plasticine, you know, bomb-proof case holder to collect the way people do with the Funko Pops or comic books.
Did you see that their CGC is offering this now for physical media? You can send your VHSs or your DVDs and they'll grade it for you. Anybody who does that should be put in a camp. And anyway, she gets the wrong one, and she's like, "Oh yay, Stanley!" And we're like, "What's the matter?" She's like, "No, it's fine." And we're like, "What's the matter?" So we wind up going and getting her the right one, because you know we're slaves to the system. Did you pay markup on eBay
to get it?
No, we just go to the store. You could still get them anywhere. It's not like they're not hard to find, except for these like limited. There's like limited Starbucks or limited Target ones, right? So there is like a Beanie Baby element to certain parts of this, but like for the most part, you just go out and get it. Whatever. It's neither here nor there. Kids want weird, dumb things all the time. I don't mind it that much. But she is now, like, it's like attached to her hand. We were walking to school the other day, and she was kind of swinging it around, and it was leaking a little bit because the lid wasn't on quite all the way. So I was like, here, take my coffee. I'll, you know, screw this on. She's like, no, mine. It's like fucking Gollum with the one ring. And I was like, first of all. You need to check yourself before you wreck yourself, ma'am. I will put that thing straight in the trash when we get home. I will throw it in the garbage. But it's funny. My wife said this the other day, and she's absolutely right. Like, the schools are going to ban these things by February because they're everywhere, but they're also just getting left everywhere. Like, for instance, I was picking my daughter up to go to a dentist appointment. And she came out of her room and she didn't have it. I was like, do you want to bring your water cup? She's like, and like froze on the spot because she didn't have it. So she had to run back to her class, get it, run back. We were almost late to the dentist appointment. As we're leaving the front office of the school, a mom is like dropping her kid off. And as she's leaving, she like looks down at the table. She's like, oh, somebody left their Stanley here. And the look on the face of the women at the front desk were just like, kill me now, because we're going to have to figure out. We're going to have to track down whose this is. We're going to have to, you know. And it's like, I don't really understand where this came from. I read up about it a little bit, but like literally what happened was a new CEO came into Stanley. He said, we want to target, our sales are $45 million a year, which is nice. We want to target the female demographic. So what we're going to do is we're going to make Stanleys in different colors.
Yep. Yep.
And we're going to have people talk about them on TikTok. And now they're doing $300 million in business a year.
But see, this is all trickle down. What you're seeing with the kids, this is all trickle down from the women, from like the modern moms, like the ladies who lunch, but they're like, and they're all over, you know, look, I'm a millennial, so I watch TikToks on Instagram and like 2 months late, but like you are behind already, Sonny, on this trend. Like this has been going on for well over a year with the Stanley.
Apparently.
And it's really only the latest iteration and maybe the greatest iteration because there have been other trendy water bottles. I mean, look, I'm holding a
Well, there's like the Yeti bottle.
So Yetis. Stanley has supplanted the Yeti, but without challenging the Yeti on quality, right? Because the whole idea of Yeti is that it's like way over engineered.
Yeah, but there's also grades of Yeti. Like you can get like what is essentially Yeti branding of a cheap, relatively cheap cup. Like it's still more expensive, but there are the true Yeti thermoses. And I don't know the details. I just know I have a couple of like clearly like they're good Yetis, but they're not great Yetis. And of course Yeti is really, it's all about selling the coolers. And
the $900 coolers,
the status symbol thing is what's important, right? Because
but
they also all serve like slightly different markets. Like Yetis are for, they're more red state America, for sure. There certainly is sort of a outdoorsman hunting to fishing to tailgating an SEC game.
Yeah, I was going to say football games.
Yeah, exactly. Like I say outdoorsman like very broadly. Like it's like, again, red state America. And then you have like, there were hydro flasks, which were a couple of years ago.
Portland.
Which were sort of
Oregon-y things.
Yeah, but also kind of, they got really in, I think like teenagers got really into them quickly and it was sort of a status symbol but this has been going on. When I was a kid, there was Nalgene. Remember Nalgene bottles?
Nalgene bottles.
Yeah, that was
indestructible, BPA free. Yeah.
Exactly.
I have a version of all of these bottles somewhere in my house, by the way. I've got like a Nalgene bottle.
Tervis.
This is a Tervis. Is that
the Camelbacks?
Yeah, that's
Camelbacks.
Yeah. Of course Camelbacks. Yeah. Well. So I mean, it's an interesting sociological like area of study for like, why is the water bottle such a status symbol?
But what's the pimp cup of the suburban mom?
That's right.
Jewel encrusted chalice.
All of our kids drink way more water than we ever did as children. So like water is like a thing that is, water itself deserves like sociological. In my view, like, what are we doing drinking all this water?
Where is big water in all this? When did big water get their hooks in us to force their, you know, pure filtered nonsense? It is fascinating on a bunch of different levels, but it just kind of happened here out of nowhere. All of a sudden, my daughter is a character who out of like Requiem for a Dream, if I take away the thing from her, and it's like it's a disaster. I don't want to go on and on about the Stanleys, but I find it fascinating because literally, like, again, every story that I've read is basically like new CEO came in and did new colors and put them on TikToks and increased the business tenfold. And it's just that's wild.
That's why you're paying them the big bucks.
Yeah. It's a great story. I love stories like that.
I was just going to say, my sense is that for whatever it's worth, what has happened is that water has displaced soda and juice, which is what my generation as kids.
Yes.
Everything we drank was like juice, so much juice.
Yes.
Was it real? No, it was all like canned stuff that was, you know.
And by the time Sonny and I came around, that was a marketing ploy. It was like 100% real juice.
100% real juice. And I think what this is basically, we just crowded out all that sugar.
Yeah.
And replace it with water, which is much better for the kids.
No, I think that's basically right. I mean, I think this is actually, it's actually a very big positive having the kids drinking the not soda, not juice all the time. That's a big win for society, frankly. But it does have weird downstream effects like water bottle wars.
Should we talk about the wedding in the outtakes here?
Please.
Are we going to do that in outtakes? We want to do that in outtakes?
I don't know. I mean,
that's a full discussion.
All right. Let's have it then. And I'll talk about my week, in the outtakes. Go ahead, Sonny. Bring us up to speed. What's going on?
Well, I mean, this story went viral last week. A coffee shop in a historic mansion. It's like a very nice Instagrammable place. Like you go there and you take pictures and you drink your little coffee and you go on. But this coffee shop posted something about how a wedding party just showed up, didn't book it or anything, just like rolled in with groomsmen, bridesmaids, and the wedding, the like people coming to the wedding, but also like the officiant and the photographer,
the guests,
and did the ceremony in the coffee shop again without booking it, without reserving it, and you know they like took up the whole store, they were putting their jackets on everything, they were blocking off the entrance to the parking lot.
Asking staff to take the
take their coats and et cetera, et cetera. And like the coffee shop basically just had to let it happen because they were afraid of getting canceled if they put a stop to the wedding. And when they reached out to the bridal party, they were like, hey, you know, this is fucked up. We have, you can rent the place for $500, there's a minimum food buy, whatever, but like We have a process for this. Everywhere has a process for this, you know. Why would you do this? And they were like, we'll give you $200 for $200 donation.
Donation. Like it was out of the goodness of their hearts.
I just saw this story and I thought to myself, like, first of all, this is brilliant. I should have done this when I got married. I should have just rolled into the hotel lobby and been like, hey, let's go. We're getting married. Getting married at the Renaissance on M Street. That's not, it's rebranded as something else now, so you can't find the historic bunch wedding site. But also, who does this? Who just rolls into an establishment and takes it over and acts like they own the place when we all decent members of society know that there's a process for things like this. You gotta rent it out. You gotta make sure it's not booked. What if there had been another wedding going on that day? What if somebody else who had, you know, paid the booking fee and was doing their thing, like showed up 30 minutes after all these people rolled in? Like, could you imagine the social media firestorm that would have happened then? Key context here. The wedding party is African American and the staff are all white, which leads to the concern of the coffee shop that they would leave, there would be some sort of cancelable event if they told them to get the fuck out like they should, because it's ridiculous.
So a couple things. And then JV, I want to hear your thoughts, but there is a trend in weddings right now for the pop-up wedding. I believe I said this over text to you guys. So yes. The pop-up wedding is like the wedding that takes place in a place where like, 5 minutes or 10 minutes before there was no wedding, and 5 minutes after the wedding, you don't know there was a wedding there. You wouldn't know there was a wedding there. This like very quick sort of a minimalist kind of response to the extravagant sort of wedding industrial complex wedding. The irony of this is that like you can pay wedding consultants to plan a pop-up wedding for you. Like you end up probably not saving that much money, or maybe you save a certain amount of money, but whatever but this is a trend. And so my theory on this is that people are aware of this trend, but they're not willing to actually do the work and pay the money to, because if you can Google this, Google like pop-up wedding and like they will go through like how to make sure that you're calling the right people and letting the venue know and understanding whether there are fees or reservations needed. Like, even the pop-up wedding is not actually a pop-up wedding. There's actual planning in it. But if you like the trend and you don't really want to do the work or spend the money, just show up at a nice coffee shop, because what are they going to do? Kick you out? And
well, right. I mean, right. The whole idea of the pop-up wedding is like, look at this. It flouts laws and conventions, but you know, but still do all the scut work and get your permits. No, people, once you unleash societal anarchy like that as pretend anarchy, then people are going to say, I'd like some real anarchy, please.
There you go. I think
there's
that's right.
Only one proper response to this. Only one. The barista, the head barista, the manager of the coffee shop, should have come over in the middle of the ceremony, broken a glass on the floor, and placed a gypsy curse on the bride and groom. Because what they did is an absolute infamia.
Infamia! Absolutely.
A gypsy curse is the only logical, frankly, response to that. What monsters? Monsters.
Well, I cannot imagine the presumptuousness of it. That's really what it comes to. That's really, I live in fear every day of inconveniencing somebody else. It's like the only thing it's the only social pressure I really feel anymore at this point is like, I don't want to be a bother to the guy who's delivering me my food, or on the very rare occasions, to the extent that I like don't get things delivered, because I don't want to have to tell the guy doing the Instacart shopping, like, no, you need to get the right thing. Like, look for it. I know it's there. I don't want to have to deal with that. I just want to go to the store myself and do it myself, because I know I am not built for confrontations of that sort. And the idea of just like, to the extent that I swear to God, this is true. I don't even like going to restaurants with groups of more than like six people.
Yeah.
Or more than like three children, because if I do that, I know I'm causing somebody trouble. We there was an event for my kid was singing at a mall somewhere as part of his school, you know, doing a little Christmas caroling, whatever. And afterwards, I was like, all right, let's go downstairs and get some food in the food court. And I was trying to get us away from all the rest of the families. And of course, two or three of the he saw his friends are like, we're gonna go get dinner. Come on. And I'm like, no, don't tell them that. I don't want them there. And so we rolled down there with like, I don't know, it was like 10 or 12 people and, you know, like five or six kids, five or six adults. And we were going to go to the Mexican restaurant that was down there. It's like a sit down place. It's not fancy, but it's also like a step above, you know, a Carlos O'Kelly's or whatever, or a Chili's. And I was like, no, we're not going to go there now. We're just going to go to the Five Guys. And even going to the Five Guys, I was like, this is really stretching it. We're going to have to push tables together. Can we just leave? Can we just leave the mall? Can we just go home and get food? Get takeout on the way home?
Do you ever wonder what it's like to walk through life as one of those people who genuinely doesn't give a shit?
Yes. It's
kings of the world. They're kings of the world.
It must be an amazing way to experience the world, right?
Not giving a fuck about anybody else or like how you inconvenience them is a genuine superpower. It's like that's a number one. That's a top
tier.
But like
I do think it. I mean because it's about lack of awareness. This is like my big thing. It's like people are unaware of where they are in time and space, and how they relate to the other objects, meaning the other people within their like vicinity. And I do think that they're like, you do in the long run lose out. Like it's great in the moment, but like you do kind of like push people away, and your life is, I think, low key, like underlying, like miserable, because people treat you poorly at restaurants because they know, you know, like they can tell what they're dealing with here. So I think in the long run, like us self-aware people, we're very, you know, we're in the driver's seat here.
Yeah, you're the real winner here, Sonny.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds right.
No, but here, okay. So the wedding, this is like all it comes out of like the wedding industrial complex though, right? Like the bride gets whatever she wants on her wedding day. The wedding is the most, it's my special day. It's the most important day. Like, that is really...
She asked him, the grooms get whatever he wants on the wedding night. Sorry.
I don't know about that. But like, there is something specific about the wedding aspect of this story that, like, that allows it to occur. So,
Michael, anyway, how are you? What's going on, buddy?
I'm fine. We, you know, we have a sick baby, yeah. Just one at the moment. But I did very quickly. I did take my oldest on Sunday to see The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring at the big show at the Alamo Draft House.
Theatrical or extended?
Extended.
Wow. It's a long one.
It is a long one. We did take one bathroom break.
Good.
So we...
When?
So...
Rivendell.
Yeah, right when they get to Rivendell, right?
No, we should have, but like we couldn't make it that long. So it was in Bree right after they meet Strider.
Well, that's good enough.
It turned
that's like
out
an hour. You still have like 2 hours left of the movie after that.
But we were fine. It was because we front loaded the sodas, you know, at the beginning of the movie. And so that was what was going on. But it turned out to be great. So like my 9-year old is how do I put this delicately? He is a little sensitive to the tensions in movies and like the way that like a score kind of builds up a moment of tension. He has a hard time like holding in his excitement. And sometimes that's like positive excitement, but a lot of times it's like negative excitement. It's like, oh, what's going to happen here? So like the Alamo pre-roll,
when the riders are looking over them and they're like hiding in the berm with the bugs coming out.
Yes.
How do you do there?
But I will say this, but before I get to that, the pre-roll at the Alamo, among the things that they showed were like trailers for old Peter Jackson movies, which are like,
oh no,
terrifying
the horror movies. Oh no.
So I quickly realized what was going on. And like, he buried his head into me and like held his ears. Again, it's like the creepy sounds and score that like gets his heart rate up. Anyway, so, but we got through it, and I would say that there were jump scares in The Lord of the Rings. There is the moment, you know, talking about the writer sniffing while they're hiding under there, but like he stuck it out for all those. And I think a big reason is he knew the story. He knew where the story was going. He understood what was going on and sort of what would generally happen next. And he was also like captured by the movie and the story itself to like, he was almost like too into it to be scared. But we did take our bathroom break, and I didn't realize it would take us this long to do it, but I was like, oh, this might be a good time. And so he missed the Nazgul stabbing the beds of the four hobbits, you know, that's a pretty scary scene, but he stuck it out. He watched the whole thing. He freaking loved it. And
had he never seen it before? Was this his first time?
Oh, first time.
Oh, how about that?
Is he a Legolas or a Gimli kind of guy? Because everybody's one of them. It's like Elvis or the Stones or Elvis.
I don't know if he's got a view on that. He loves Pippin, as everybody does. Like Pippin is hilarious. And
I'm a Boromir.
Yeah, that tracks, honey. But
you have a weapon, you might as well use it.
Yeah, he loves Pippin, and he loves...
I would only use it for good.
Of course. So anyway, it was great. It was great to see it in a theater. Like, it was just like terrific to see the extended edition in the theater. I will say, I picked up on things I did not pick up when I first watched these movies. Like the wide shots with the either little people or child stand-ins for like Frodo and like are very obvious, you know, in retrospect. Really? Like,
once you know to look for them.
Well, I didn't even know to look for it, but you know, it's that thing where you've seen a movie so many times that you start looking in the screen for other things. And there's a wide shot in the very beginning where Gandalf and Frodo are on the wagon. And they zoom out to show Hobbiton and the Shire and all this stuff. And it's so obviously clearly, it's small, But it's so obviously clearly not Elijah Wood sitting next to Ian McKellen. It's a little person with darker hair than Frodo has sitting next to, anyway. And it's like, it just jumped out of me. But I think
it's like watching Reacher and like knowing to look for the Force perspective.
Yes.
Or the like shots where he's clearly standing on a box or whatever. Like once you know to look for those things, it's like, oh yeah, here it is again.
But you know,
and that is almost the, so I had almost that exact same response to the movie when I rewatched it on 4K. I got the 4K set last year at some point, was rewatching it. And like, because it's so clear, because like you could, I mean, like there's 4K. 4Ks. There's four.
It's got four of them.
It's because it's so clear, you can really see like the like wigs and the little people. And especially any shot where everybody is standing kind of side by side,
correct?
And you see them from behind or whatever. It's like, oh yeah, that's a stand-in. That's not the real actor.
But I will say it holds up so like it just as a movie experience so well, and it just reminds me of like what an achievement it really was to like make that movie and make those movies. You know, the other thing I will say is, I had warned him about this, that like, there will be different things, because we've just read the first two volumes of the books. And I was like, there's going to be different things. There's no Tom Bombadil, you know, there's no Barrow White.
Dad, where's Tom Bombadil?
Exactly. But then he was sort of like, he like got it. He was like, oh yeah, you really couldn't like include him. I was like, think about how much longer the movie would be. He's like, yeah. So it was a great outing.
Tom Bombadil sucks.
We don't need to open that can of worms again. But the Barrow White would be cool to see. The Barrow White would be really cool to see, and you can't have the Barrow White without Tom Bombadil, but that would be super scary. Anyway, that's what's going on with me. Should we move on to a box office talk real quick?
Yeah. Yes, I've been dying to talk about the box office.
Box office! People demand it in the comments. They send you Prana links. They demand more box office talks. We're going to talk box office. Big news. Like,
I feel like I am the shield, the human shield in front of JVL's hatred of the box office talk, because I'm the one who gets out in front and says, let's not maybe talk about it. And you're hiding behind my bravery, JVL. Just saying that. Let's talk about the box office, though. Number one at the box office is Wonka.
Don't care about that. Don't care about
number two is Night Swim.
Number three. When we get to number five is where interesting things start to happen. So at number five is Anyone But You, which grossed, it grossed $9.75 million this week. You think, oh, that's not that big a deal. $9.75 million in its third weekend. That's not it. But it's a very interesting story with this movie. So it has now grossed more in each of its successive weekends. It grossed more in its second weekend than it grossed in its first. It grossed more in its third weekend than it grossed in its second. And as far as anyone can tell, as far as any of the box office watchers I follow, as far as I know, this has never happened for a movie that has opened on more than 2,000 screens. This has never happened for a movie that has opened wide. A movie grossing more in its second weekend than its first, and then more in its third weekend than its second. Which is really interesting. And a second little nugget here that I haven't seen anybody really dig into, but is like equally interesting. Again, for a movie that opened on more than 2,000 screens, it hit number one at the daily box office on its, I believe, 18th day. Which is, again, that's unprecedented. I've never seen that happen with a movie. Now, again, We're talking about a kind of weakened box office, right? You know, it's still recovering. The competition out right now is not terribly strong. But it's really interesting to see a genuine word of mouth hit like this kind of take off. You know, the last time it really happened was The Greatest Showman, right? Where The Greatest Showman opened to like $12 million or something like that, and then did a multiple of 14 or 15 and ended up grossing $160 million domestically.
Right.
Excuse me. But it's, but even
Who
The Greatest Showman.
Star? What is it? Is it a rom-com?
So Anyone But You is a rom-com starring Glenn Powell of Top Gun Maverick fame and Sydney Sweeney, who is best known for having a very
great acting skills.
She's buxom. She's buxom. And it is a throwback rom-com, high concept rom-com where you have two attractive people who are like not really into each other at first, but they're definitely totally into each other. And then they get together at the end. It's like it's
Shakespeare, isn't it?
Formula. It's based on Shakespeare. You make a modern retelling of Shakespeare. You put two hot people in it. That's box office gold, is my understanding. It's been true for ages.
Question. Question. Yes. Two questions, actually. First question. Have you seen it, Sonny?
I've not. Okay. I don't want to go see it. So like the only time I really have to go see it would be like in the middle of the day. When the kids aren't around, but I don't want to go see this in the middle of the day with nobody else in the theater. I want to see it with a packed audience full of laughing, joyous people. I want to get the experience. That's inappropriate, JVL. That's not what we're here for on this show. Anyway,
second question. Is this a film in
R rated? It's R rated.
Does the star of the film show skin?
My understanding is that both of the stars show some skin. So there's, okay, you know, so, it's an R-rated romantic comedy. There's language, there's some sexual... Here, let's look up...
So
let's
there's
see what
word
the MPAA
of mouth,
says.
I think, is, so
MPAA
to speak, is,
rating anyone on. But you.
It is R.
Let's see. Rated R for... Hold on. Rated R for language throughout, sexual content, and brief graphic nudity. So
like that is a huge, I mean, I don't mean to take away from the two stars, you know, considerable acting talents, but like that's word of mouth getting out. Right? Like that's what's getting this movie.
I don't think you really need.
Isn't she naked on HBO? Like,
yeah, I don't think
week?
You need to go to see this movie to necessarily get the full Monty.
Okay. All right, I'm just saying.
But I'm just saying it's a big box office story. Congratulations to the folks at Anyone But You.
Yes.
Hopefully you can make it four weekends in a row, increasing the box office. We're bringing the box office back, baby.
It's coming up. Okay, well, we are not talking about Anyone But You. We are talking about what's at number 9 on last week's box office, Ferrari. Ferrari by Michael Mann. Sonny, you want to give us a big boy review of Ferrari?
Michael Mann's Ferrari. It's based on Enzo Ferrari, the man, the cars, the machines, by Brock Yates. It's an interesting Michael Mann movie in that. The story here is basically Enzo Ferrari. It's 1957. He's about to go broke. The Ferrari company is about to go broke. They're getting pressure from Maserati and the other sport car companies. He might have to take a loan from Ford, to stabilize the brand. There's all sorts of domestic drama because he has a longtime mistress, and this is very annoying to his wife. The mistress is played by Shailene Woodley. The wife is played by Penelope Cruz. Adam Driver plays Enzo Ferrari. The thing it is first and foremost is unusual for a Michael Mann movie to be this directly about this topic. It is a movie about fathers and sons and legacy and kind of what it means to have a child and to be a dad. I don't want to say it's the best scene, but the kind of most interesting scene comes very early on. Enzo Ferrari goes to the gravesite of his son. He goes there every day, and he's sitting there and he's talking to the boy about, you know, how he sees his brother in his dreams. But when he closes his eyes, he always sees his son, and he gets choked up, and it's very emotional. And again, this is unusual for Michael Mann, who is a director who has made all of his movies are about alpha males doing alpha male things, being excellent at business, excellent at fighting, excellent at computer hacking, whatever. And here is a movie that deals with the more personal rather than professional side of life in a way that is like almost it's more intimate than what we usually see from his films. which I find, again, I find very interesting. I find it fascinating that for a guy who has for so long dealt with what it like masculinity at a very high level, that this has never really been a topic he has tackled. It's never been something that has interested him. It's always been kind of off to the side. The closest you see it really is in Last of the Mohicans, particularly the relationship between the two natives, the two actual natives, and their relationship with Daniel Day-Lewis. But this is an entirely different thing. It's entirely different, I think it mostly works. I haven't talked at all about the actual cars or the racing yet. The last 40 minutes of this movie essentially are one long car race, and they are about as tense of car races as I have ever seen committed to film. Like
Better than Gran Turismo.
It's the yes, even more than Gran Turismo. It's the
Miglia.
I don't know. It's the 1,000-mile race in Italy, and it's a street race. It's on the streets of Italy, and it puts the cars right next to spectators, which you know may come back to haunt some people later in the movie. But it also just like puts the cars right on each other with these hairpin turns. And I found all that stuff great and wonderful. I feel like it's a slightly more subdued visually, movie from Michael Mann than, some of his previous efforts. I wouldn't say there's a lack of style, but it's not self-consciously stylish.
Yes.
In how he moves the camera or how he shoots it. It's shot almost in a very, it's shot with digital film, digital video, you know, so it's got kind of a flat look to it, but it works great with low light. That sequence at the beginning of the race where they started at night is just wonderful and fantastic. Anyway, I like this movie quite a bit. And I find it fascinating as a capstone for an 84-year-old director kind of like putting a summation on a career that he's old,
so he may not
or
make
maybe he
movie.
May be 81 I like he's but he's a
he's
you
in
know,
his
Michael, 80s. Michael Mann's been around forever,
so this could be his last movie.
Could very well. Yeah, he's 80. He turns 81 February 5th, so he turns 81 in a month. This could be his
last
movie.
Work fast.
No, it's been almost 10 years since Black Hat came
Black
out.
Black Hat?
I think.
Yeah. This is probably his last film then. Wow.
Well, in theory, he said he's trying to get Heat 2 together. So we'll see how that goes.
Heat 2 Electric.
I didn't see it. And I am sorry, guys, but it was not playing anywhere near me. I had to, it was 22 miles away was the nearest theater to go see it in. And I am sorry, but I was not going to do like 45-mile round trip to see this movie. And I feel bad about it, but it did strike me as being really fucking weird that it just wasn't playing in my county in New Jersey. Maybe the Irish, like, you know, were being anti-Italian or something.
Anti-Italian discrimination.
I did rewatch Heat as my homework.
You rewatched Heat.
I did
good
rewatch
movie.
Heat. Michael, what did you think? Did you like it? Did you love it?
I loved this movie, and I think a lot of it had to do with the performances, and the other part had to do with the, as Sonny said, the final 40-minute, race. I totally agree with you, Sonny, that it's like one of the most thrilling car races in a film I've ever seen. The tension was both on the level of the cars themselves, you know, can they make these turns? Can they, this is dangerous, you know, seeing all of these spectators standing right there while these cars are going, you know, at ungodly speeds. And also on the sort of personal level, I mean, you don't get to know as well as I would have liked the whole racing team, but you do get to know the sort of the main driver a little bit. the one with the actress girlfriend, the blonde girlfriend. And there's sort of a character tension, and drama there too. But I mean, Adam Driver, maybe everybody already knew that Adam Driver was this terrific top tier, acting talent, but you know, I was sort of, I grew in my appreciation for him because, there's so much that he has to do with his, without saying things, without, you know, with just his facial expressions or his body language that I just thought was terrific. And Penelope Cruz, I mean, the two of them, I think of the three main actors, Shailene Woodley was sort of the least convincing. Like there, I felt like, well, wait a second. Is she really Italian? Is she supposed to be Italian? Is she like American? But then she looked like speaking Italian. So I thought she was sort of the weak link of the three, but, I loved it. I loved, I do have a question though. So is this in the same cinematic universe as Ford versus Ferrari? Do we have an idea? I think it's interesting that like we have Ford versus Ferrari a few years ago. Now we have Ferrari. It's interesting that we have this interest, and maybe it's because he's an 80-year-old director, but like in a car culture that is like really doesn't exist anymore. I find all of this such an interesting topic.
Yeah, I mean, he's been trying to get this movie made for like 15 or 20 years. Like the guy who wrote it, the credited screenwriter, died a while ago, like not recently. Let me see if I can.
That's right, because he was trying to get other actors before Adam Driver was even on the scene. I remember reading about this. He wanted somebody else to play Enzo Ferrari.
Troy Kennedy Martin died, who is the credited screenwriter. He died in September of 2009. So, you know, this
15
movie,
years ago.
Yeah. So this movie is, it's been in gestation for a while.
He had wanted initially Christian Bale and Hugh Jackman to play Ferrari. So,
well, Christian Bale did the other Ford versus Ferrari movie.
Well, I mean, I think one of the reasons this movie gets green lit at a $80 or $90 million budget, however much it cost, is because of Ford versus Ferrari. Ford versus Ferrari comes out and does huge business, and they're like, "Oh yeah, people want car movies." And it turns out what they actually wanted was Matt Damon and Christian Bale car movie, specifically.
How does the car stuff compare? So the racing stuff, how does it compare? So this is the third big-ish racing movie we've had, right? Ford versus Ferrari, Gran Turismo, and now this. How does this?
I mean, I
is it different? Is it more visceral? Is it more real and practical versus all the CGI stuff that shows up in Gran Turismo?
There's definitely some CGI in Ferrari, but it feels more practical, and it feels more. The theater I was in, which was, I did not go to the Alamo to see this. I saw this in the art house, local theater where like all the boomer, like it was all boomer couples in my theater, like watching this movie. But like the sound of the engines was more visceral, I thought, even in sort of, you know, kind of crummy, non-stadium seating, non-Dolby theater. I thought it was terrific. I mean, there's wide shots. There's like close shots where you're watching, you know, from the point of view of the driver. I would say the hairpin turns. They do a great job of like showing you how freaking close it all is. You know, how like one wrong turn like ends up with people dying, and like spoiler alert, like that's what happens at one point. So I just thought it was full of great tension and it was a great time, right, Sonny?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the digital versus practical question is an interesting one, and I wish I knew a little better, frankly. To the extent that I was asked to submit nominations for the Vulture Stunt Awards this year. I was asked to participate in that. And like, I picked a couple sequences from this movie, but like, you know, I didn't want to pick the so there's a fairly shocking death towards the end of the film. I didn't want to pick that because that's definitely not practical. That was done digitally.
Yes.
But there's clearly a lot of like actual bumping of paint taking turns, yes. that sort of thing, that was done practically. I just don't know. I don't know what extent. I'll say this. It's put together pretty seamlessly. Whatever is digital versus practical all melds together very nicely. So I have no complaints about the realism of it.
I will say I love Italy in this movie, like the just all these terrific shots of, like the where the big dramatic scene in the climactic scene in the race with those, like the street, the road with the pines lining it. We've watched like several movies in it that were filmed in Italy this past year. And
yeah, I guess that's right.
Like it's always you could tell, you know, why these filmmakers love making movies in Italy. It's just so beautiful. And, you can film a period piece in these places. You probably don't have to do much because like a lot of these places have not changed since
Italy is a special effect.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think I texted you guys that like what the reaction you guys had to Iron Claw is kind of how, what I had to Ferrari. I just thought like, what a story, what, you know, and I'm not like a huge car history guy, but I love cars and I love like watching like racing and I'm interested in all of that.
Did you have supercar posters on your bedroom wall when you were like 10 years old, 12 years old?
I made car models. I was definitely interested in like making.
Were you a Ferrari guy or a Lambo guy? Because all young suburban boys are one of the two, right?
Correct. So I will say in my wayward youth, I was a Lamborghini kid, but I much more appreciate Ferrari now. Lamborghinis were like sexy and cool, you know, and it's like, Lamborghini is like, you know, the hot supermodel in a bikini, you know, but like Ferrari will stick with you, you know, through thick and thin.
The Testarossa. When I was like 10 years old, the Testarossa was like the beau ideal of what a sports car should be.
Oh. I think they do. I mean, this is just part of the story, but the, the character of Enzo Ferrari is like this sort of, you know, middlingly successful car racer turned sort of race car empire builder. Like it just, I love that story as well. It's like subtle and it's kind of in the background of the story, but you know, the sort of the way that he transformed his, you know, and built this empire himself after kind of struggling and racing. I don't know. It's a great story. And the father son stuff is it hit me, I would say, in a emotional way where I think Iron Claw hit you guys. Yeah, totally. So, I don't know. Any other thoughts? Any other Michael Mann thoughts?
Well, JBL, you rewatched, Heat.
Yeah. I keep waiting to reach the point where I realize that Heat isn't actually that good, but every time I see it, I like it more rather than less. And here is something I've come away from this watching. First of all, I've been thinking, is it time for Flash to see Heat? Is 15 too young for Heat?
I feel like it's a college movie. Like, it's the kind of movie that you like, you have to, you'd appreciate more like as an 18 year old in the dorm.
Parts of it are just brutal.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, so here's the thought I have. Kevin Gage is the actor who plays Wayne Grow. And I propose that this is a movie which succeeds because it's perfect in every level. But one of the ways in which it is perfect is that the supporting cast is phenomenal. And yeah. So Ted Levine, for instance, just kind of owns every scene he's in, even though he's a background character. And Wayne Grow might be the most convincing psychopath I've ever seen on screen. So much so that when you watch it with Kevin Gage, I honestly had difficulty believing that this guy wasn't just some biker gang psychopath that Michael Mann picked up off the street. And in fact, Wingro did wind up going to jail for a couple of years for growing and distributing marijuana late in life. But he's just been a working actor for like 40 years at this point. And he's not an actual psychopath, despite the fact that he spent 2 years in minimum security prison. And his character is so important because we have to be kind of rooting for Robert De Niro, right? And the way to really make us root for him is that Wingro has to be totally evil, and we have to be very, very happy that De Niro, A, makes the decision to try to kill him, and B, that De Niro finally gets him at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And so that is, Wingro is an important character script-wise for keeping the audience invested in Neil, because otherwise we might, you know, we might not hold Neil and Detective Hanna in the same regard, where we're kind of rooting for both of them. Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah. So to your point about, sorry, JV, I don't mean to interrupt, but to your point about the actors, the supporting actors in this movie, I just like pulled up the cast
Bill
list
Fichtner.
Here. It's insane when you look at this.
President Palmer,
Ashley
Danny
Judd, Michael T. Williamson.
Michael T. Williams is amazing.
Hank Azaria, Danny Trejo, Tone Loc is in this movie, right?
Tone Loc is so good in this movie.
Yes.
911 right? Slow.
I love it. Bud Cort is in this movie.
And the extent to which
Harold Amott.
This is not new, but I know this is long. I'm sure we've talked about this on the show before. We ought to do a Heat episode, by the way, on a slow week, because we could easily get a whole show out of Heat. Al Pacino treats this as opera to the extent where he's practically pitching his voice throughout lots of it. I mean, he's not really sing-song, but a lot of his dialogue is delivered like it's spoken word almost, where he is, you know, pitching his words at different notes. And it's an astonishing performance that he does. And then the contrast between how totally buttoned up De Niro is within these moments when the rage bursts out of him. It's just really, I don't know, like it would be easy for those to be cardboard cutout characters, but they're not. They're very deep and interesting characters. And I don't know, man, everything about this movie is phenomenal.
What question?
Yeah.
Alternative universe after Heat, Al Pacino and Robert De Niro just retire from acting. Is that a better world? Like going out on top?
No, I mean, way. They've given so much great performance.
Since then, I mean, Robert De Niro has just become such a, you know, a parody of
Casino
himself.
We've gotten
so
Casino.
Does Casino come after that? I thought Casino was
before.
That's what I'm saying. It feels like
pretty sure.
Godfather 3. Like
That's all before.
I think De Niro, so Jackie Brown comes out after.
Okay.
After.
I'm just saying it feels like the sort of like what, like where else could they go? Like, I don't know. All their best stuff is behind them after Heat.
I mean, that's
Any Given Sunday. That's
Sunday. Yeah. Oh, Pacino. That's true. Any Given Sunday is amazing.
Yeah, that's true. That's
I don't know. I will think about this for a second while we look at this, but I mean, look, not a lot of it is perfect, but there is still some great stuff they do during it.
And The Insider, that's another.
The Insider. How can we even forget The Insider? That's unbelievable.
And Christopher Nolan, Insomnia.
Yeah.
I think you
are wrong on this.
Okay, I'm willing to believe I'm wrong. I just literally just thought of it.
Here are movies that come out after 1995, which is Heat and Casino come out in the same year. Let's see, what is there? There's Sleepers, Copland, Jackie Brown, Wag the Dog, Ronin. This.
Yeah. Ronin.
The Score.
Killers of the Flower Moon.
Killers of the Flower Moon, exactly.
Joker.
Let's see what else. I don't know. I mean, like there, he definitely has a look. He has a Silver Linings Playbook. He has an absolute. I would say he has more misses than hits in the last 10 years or so of his career. But that stretch is like crazy. The stretch where people are like, oh, you know, maybe after Goodfellas, there's a, but like Goodfellas, Cape Fear. A Bronx Tale, Casino, Heat.
Yeah, these guys also are much closer to the British theory of acting than almost any of their contemporaries, which they're not like Tom Hanks hunting around for perfect important roles.
Sure.
Like they're working actors, you know, like De Niro just like wants to be working every day. And so in the same way, like Michael Caine has, you know, 15 amazing performances tucked in amongst like 95 credits, many of which are
Jaws 4,
whatever. Right. Yep. It's just because they like to work. And I like that.
Okay. All right. I withdraw.
Retract.
I retract.
I want to do a Heat episode though at some point. That's my only, request.
Let's put that on the calendar.
Because it is, oh man.
Got some slow weeks coming up.
Yeah.
All right. Any final thoughts on Ferrari, Michael Mann, Heat, weddings?
How many screens was it on this week, Sonny?
I will effort that. It was on a little over 2,100 screens.
Really?
Yeah.
Whatever.
It's losing most of those this weekend.
Okay.
So.
I am surprised it wasn't playing near you, like even like a one midday showing, though. That is a little bit weird.
Normally, like, you know, like one of the, I have like three different 16 screen multiplexes within 5 miles of me. Mm-hmm. And almost, you know, on any given day, you can catch even like some obscure anime movie that's anime. I don't know how you pronounce
anime.
It. Anime movie. You can catch it for like a 1:30 screening on one of the smaller auditoriums. Like, I mean, and this just wasn't playing, period, the end.
Weird. That is weird.
Anti-Manites. Weird.
All right. Well, get in your chance to see Ferrari because it's disappearing. And that is all the time we're going to give to this episode. Join us at subbeacon.com and we will talk to you next time.
Can't wait to talk about Reacher.
Reacher!
Yeah,
Reacher. Got Reacher chat coming up on Monday. It's going to be great.
Get excited. I will say this. Here's my outtake. So watching this, I've been spoiled by the Alamo Drafthouse. So like watching this movie in, you know, very old theater, cheap theater, where like you literally just walk in the door and you are in the theater. There's no sort of, you know, little path you got to walk by, you know, it's all pre, stadium seating. There was a guy on a date with a woman, maybe his wife, maybe his girlfriend, sitting behind me the whole time, just like making these comments under his breath. And I was like, this is savage. This is savagery.
Why didn't you move? I would have gotten up in the middle of the movie and looked at him.
I did look at him several times, and I almost moved. Once the racing started, I couldn't hear him, so it didn't matter. But like the very first scene where Enzo Ferrari wakes up and he's in bed with Shailene Woodley, and like we're just getting to know who he is. And if you don't know anything about the movie or you don't know anything about the subject, you're sort of like, you're just seeing him wake up. And I can hear this guy goes, "That's his mistress." And I was just, I like turned around. I was like, I wouldn't be like, shut the fuck up.
It's wild going to a movie not at the Draft House now, because the clientele is not good at many of these theaters. The clientele does not behave. I went to see The Beekeeper on IMAX at a AMC at the AMC on like a Saturday night preview. It was like a paid preview. People could go see it and whatever. And I went to go see that. And the audience, it was pretty full. It was like 85-90% full, the theater. And the audience was a lot of people looking at their phones.
This is getting
up and going.
This is all I have is AMCs anymore.
Drink beer, like go out, buy beers and, you know, coming back and just talking. talking amongst themselves.
Like they're in their basements.
Did I tell you what my AMC is doing now, where they now have like mystery movie? And so it's like Thursday night at 8:30, they'll tell you what it's rated, but that's it. And you buy it, tickets are $5, and you just show up and go in, and then they put a movie on. And I'm sort of curious as to see what's going on. You think that they are test screening?
I think that they are. What they are doing is monetizing. Somebody somewhere is monetizing test screenings. Maybe not even AMC. Maybe it's like the studios themselves,
right?
Because, like, you know, the way these things work, the way a test screening works is a studio essentially rents a theater. They pay $1,000 for the theater, and then they fill it with people. And then, you know, the theater gets the $1,000 rental fee plus whatever, you know, concessions, et cetera. My working theory on this is that, the studios are like, maybe we can cover the $1,000.
Yeah, I'm sure it's fine.